From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
Today we go to Moscow to speak with analyst Mark Sloboda, and we've got a few stories we're looking at. Pretty volatile week on the diplomatic front, and let's chat about some of it.
Don, thanks for having me. It's always an honor and a pleasure to be with you on CPR.
The pleasure is ours.
Where do you want to start?
I don't know. First, there was an exchange of bootings between NATO and Russia of their representatives. First, NATO expelled some members of Russia's delegation to NATO, I assume from Brussels. That's where they're headquartered, right?
Yes.
And then we've heard today that Moscow has reciprocated more or less.
Yes. Just over 2 weeks after NATO expelled eight Russian diplomats for being undeclared intelligence agents from Brussels headquarters, Moscow has responded, and it has responded with you could say an escalation. It has completely suspended its operations of its mission to NATO, and it is kicking NATO's staff out of Moscow, and said that if NATO wants to have a conversation with Russia, they can visit the Russian ambassador in Brussels.
Right.
And this series of events, both of them, what preceded the kicking out of these eight Russian diplomats from NATO headquarters in since 1997, NATO and Russia have had a NATO-Russia Council, which is supposed to basically be a talk shop, a dialogue forum between Russia and NATO, between each other. And that is basically what this is closing down again completely. This happened in 2014. It was gradually reopened, although without any real substantial progress made between the two sides, and now it's being shut down again. If you'll remember the UNGA meeting about a month ago, according to U.S. mainstream media reports, on the sidelines of that, there was a very heated private meeting between the Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov and the Secretary General of NATO, Jens Stoltenberg. Mm. According to these, again, U.S. media reports, Lavrov accused NATO and NATO member states of, you know, just crazy things like openly participating in the overthrow of the democratically elected Ukrainian government in 2014, with a vanguard of, you know, neo-Nazis was the term that was used, Banderite fascists, if you will, you know, which is just completely crazy talk. I mean, how could Lavrov accuse NATO of exactly what happened?
Right, exactly. I know. I mean, let's see. That wasn't John McCain standing on a stage in Kiev egging on people who were occupying the space outside the parliament, and it wasn't Vicky Nuland handing out cookies and $4 billion, I think, to prepare for the day. And they're not Nazis goose-stepping around Kiev right now.
The InfoWar outlet, Hromadskaya, was the primary organizing vehicle of the Maidan. They helped organize people to get there.
Right.
And everything. They were literally set up, both financially and equipment-wise, openly by the U.S. and Dutch embassies. They're quite proud of this. You know, there's articles online talking how they're quite proud of this. And, you know, the own people who were involved in the Maidan have been quite open that, you know, if it wasn't for Hromadske, they never would have succeeded, that it was their primary, you know, organizing information dissemination vehicle set up by the U.S. and Dutch embassies. And I remember, you know, watching it at the time, and their constant 24-hour tagline on their Hromadske video TV was Revolutia, or Revolution.
Revolution, right.
Yes, funded by the U.S. and Dutch embassies.
Right.
So, you know, take that, you know, for what it's worth there. And, you know, the Russian president has been even more explicit in saying that, well, they were handing out, you know, salaries in dollar bills to people participating in the Maidan, you know, these 3 months of camping out in, you know, Independence Square in Kiev, which is not to say that they wouldn't have come anyway, you know, that they were simply just paid to be there. But this is facilitating money, because a large number of the participants of the Maidan were from the west side of the far west of the country,
right.
Galicia, Lvov, that region there. And to enable these ultranationalists to keep several hundred people on the streets of Kiev throughout the week in between the big protests on the weekends, well, you know, this gave them the financial ability to quit their jobs or you know, otherwise fund themselves for being there. You know, that's the way
right.
these things are done.
Right, so, right, right.
Anyway.
That was one ridiculous thing that was an accusation that was thrown by Lavrov at Stoltenberg, who was the head of NATO.
Yes, Stoltenberg evidently was very upset about this.
How
dare. 2 weeks later, NATO kicked out 8 Russian diplomats,
right.
Not declaring them persona non grata, simply revoking their credentials. And now Russia has responded by saying, okay, all right, let's shut the whole thing down.
Right.
So now diplomatic relations are once again closed between NATO and Russia, with Russia basically saying it's not like we were doing anything constructive anyway with each
right.
other.
Right, right, exactly. And there are two separate steps here, right? They've got both a military liaison mission in Moscow, which is
yes.
going to be going
military,
November 1st.
Yeah. Shut down, yes. Right.
And also the NATO information office in Moscow,
yes,
which
yes.
works out of the Belgian embassy.
So,
yep.
Yeah.
So, yeah. And Lavrov says, he's quoted in Sputnik, if NATO has any urgent matters, they can turn to our Belgian ambassador who deals with bilateral relations
between Russia and the Kingdom of Belgium.
And he said yes. there's no military contact anyway between
yeah.
Russia and NATO.
Yes.
Yikes.
Oh,
so, this
yeah.
is one. Is this substantive or for show, do you think?
Well, again, it's not like the NATO-Russia Council was resulting in anything constructive. It's not like there was really – I mean, both, you know, NATO and Russia are having ever larger military drills on both sides of their respective borders.
Again,
right?
this is after Trump, right? Year. I mean, they more or less had them. They were really hot and heavy up to Obama's last days. And as a matter of fact,
yeah.
there was a whole expulsion of diplomats that took place in December of 2016 and January of 2017. And then Trump stopped some of them, right? The stuff around Korea, at least.
Yeah, there. That was during his negotiations, because that was North Korea's primary demand.
Right.
That U.S. media never seems to talk about.
Right.
They want an end to the war, and they want an end to U.S.-Korean military drills on their border.
Right.
And every time North Korea tests a new missile, and they're proclaiming, you know, oh, North Korea is backing out of that again, almost certainly, if you will look carefully, you will see that directly preceding that
was another
U.S.-South Korean
right.
military drill on North Korea's border.
Right.
And North Korea's letting them know that they don't like that, and that's
right.
how they respond.
Right.
Right. But the media never actually mentions that as, you know, the reason, that raison d'être for, you know, what has happened there. So, Yeah. So, I mean, this is ever escalating tensions between the two sides, ever escalating military drills on both sides. We've seen a number of provocations in the Black Sea, in the Baltic Sea, even in the far north, in the White Sea.
Oh, God.
Then that leads us right to another incident that occurred on Friday and over the weekend. Russia and China were engaged in now regular joint naval drills in the Sea of Japan. Mm. And the Sea of Japan has as literal states around it, Japan, of course, Russia, Vladivostok is just on the other side, and the two Koreas.
Right.
And we saw an incident just last year there where the U.S. naval ship, the USS John McCain, challenged Russia's territorial waters there, claiming that Russia had excessive maritime claims, which is a little odd because the U.S. doesn't even recognize, is not a signatory to the U.N. Convention on the Law of the Sea. This was, you know, seen rightly by the Kremlin as a military provocation at the time. And now a year later, we saw during joint Russia-China naval drills, we saw another such military provocation. A U.S. military warship, destroyer, the Chafee, was in the area, an area that Russia and China say were closed for these naval drills, which is a normal convention. You know, it's part of the rules of enshrined in the UN Convention of Law of the Sea that the U.S., even though it's not a signatory, usually abides by, as most countries do. And this ship was actually headed directly towards the territorial waters, the state border of the Russian Federation, in the Peter the Great Bay. This is an Arleigh Burke-class guided missile destroyer, right? It's not an insignificant ship to be there. And it was eventually driven off by a close situation with the Russia's anti-submarine vessel, the Admiral Tributes. The U.S. ship finally changed course to avoid a collision. Almost immediately after this, within like 24-hour cycle, the U.S. also again had a spy plane intercepted by Russian aircraft, again heading right towards the Russian borders in perhaps a more routine such incident. But once again, this was over an area of Russian-Chinese joint military drills. So we see provocations in the area by both sea and by air. At the same time, the U.S. and Canada sent naval vessels once again into the Strait of Taiwan. This would be the ninth time in 8 months that Joe Biden has sent U.S. naval ships through the Taiwan Straits off the coast of Taiwan. And of course, this is seen as continuing now almost routine military provocations, military coercion, saber rattling by the United States right off of China's own coast again and again and again. And I always find it fascinating the language that is used. We saw an incident that we talked about last week where the U.S. says that China flying planes off of its own coast in international airspace, although in the very edge of Taiwan's not legally backed self-declared air defense identification zone. But there is military coercion and a provocation. But the U.S. parading naval ships regularly on the other side of the Pacific Ocean, not off of its own coast, but off of China's, that is good freedom of navigation exercises. despite the fact that China has never denied commercial navigation to any ship in the area. They depend on large amounts of international trade from the United States and every other country going in and out of
more than anyone else in the world, I think, right?
Yeah, certainly. I mean, the largest economy in the world, certainly the largest exporter, you know, economy in the world. They bring natural resources in, often by ship, and they send finished products out. That's what they do. That's why so many U.S. companies have set up shop there over the decades, because of the cheap labor, manufacturing labor. You know, that has you know, resulted in such large growth of the Chinese economy, of course. There again, if there's any challenge to freedom of navigation and free trade on the world seas, you know, we have seen repeatedly that that is actually the U.S. on its allies, with their repeated incidents of state piracy and attacks on Iranian vessels when they have had vessels seized, when Israel has attacked Iranian vessels. You know, on behalf of the U.S.'s unilaterally declared illegal sanctions on Iran, not allowing them to even trade oil with Syria, which, of course, the U.S. is still military occupying East Syria, sitting on Syria's oil fields. So they have big, huge fuel crisis there, which is resulting in a fuel and economic crisis in Lebanon as well. You know, and the whole reason is being destabilized just incredibly from you know, these actions by the U.S. But, you know, hey, freedom of navigation exercises off of China's coast, right? So we see during the same weekend, military provocations off Russia's coast in the east, military provocations off China's coast, you know, also in the Pacific there, both on the other side of the world from the United States itself. And you know, it's quite clear who the aggressive provocateur is in both situations. They're not happening off of the U.S.'s coast. They're not happening off of Alaska or Hawaii or California, for God's sakes. They're happening off of China and Russia's coast.
That's crazy. So, I mean, so meanwhile, by the way, so we have reports from all over the world, really, that China recently tested some new hypersonic weapon.
Yes.
China just denied that that's what it was, as a matter of fact. And so, you know, that's all playing in the background. And,
yes.
I mean, this is what the 1938 looked like, in a way. You've got, I mean,
yep.
and 1913 also. You've got all these things that are in, you know, in motion, and all kind of around, you know, war making and like just, you know, waiting for a match.
So let's discuss this hypersonic missile situation, right?
Okay,
what is a hypersonic missile? A hypersonic missile is a missile, often a cruise missile or a glide vehicle. They are generally, they're capable of carrying either conventional or nuclear warheads.
Right.
That they travel at extremely high speeds, ballistic missile speeds. You know, we're talking up to Mach 5.
Right.
But unlike a conventional ballistic missile, which, you know, goes into a high trajectory, you know, often, you know, through the atmosphere, off into space, and then back down, these are capable of hugging the Earth much closer.
Right.
And they're often maneuverable and traveling at very high speeds. So they are meant to evade missile defense. That's why they exist, right? Missile defense, usually they're about calculating the trajectories of conventional ballistic missiles, hypersonic cruise missiles, hypersonic glide vehicles, which just fly at a slightly higher altitude than hypersonic cruise missiles. They you know, completely nullify missile defense.
Right.
And we have a hypersonic weapon race, arms race now, between Russia, China, and the United States, and to a lesser extent other countries like India and the EU as well. Why? Why are we in this new arms race? Because the U.S. unilaterally pulled out of the anti-ballistic missile treaty in the early 2000s with George W. Bush, and has gone about setting up missile defense around the world, in Europe, in Poland, in Romania, in Japan, the THAAD systems, you know, and of course around its own borders and maritime assets around the world. You know, this is, you know, other countries, particularly Russia and China, saying, all right, you are presenting a threat with this missile defense capability by pulling out of the treaty and developing it and deploying it to our strategic deterrent. That is dangerous because then we no longer have the, you know, at some point, right, we no longer have the mutually assured destruction of each other. So we need to restore our nuclear deterrent, and we can do that cheaper by developing new missiles than we can deploying global missile defense systems. Often we don't have the huge global network of bases, you know, that are most necessary for that. So they've developed these weapons. Russia has already tested and started actual deployment of several different ones. They just tested the Tsarkon just last week as well. And now we have word that China has. Now, the official word from China, this happened in August, by the way. It's just now being reported of a military leak, you know, intentional leak to the Financial Times, that China tested this in August. It was a hypersonic glide vehicle. This missile actually circumnavigated the entire world before then engaging its target. And supposedly it was something like 24 miles off, right? Again, obviously this is still in the development stage, but U.S. military is saying unofficially that, of course, this is far more advanced along the lines than they actually thought that China was. And if you were paying attention, the U.S. tested a hypersonic missile back in April of this year, and it was a complete failure.
I didn't see that part. I just saw that they were testing them. Oh, really?
Yeah. It was a complete flub. You know, this is something. Here, CNN: U.S. Air Force test to launch ultra-fast hypersonic missile fails back in April 6, 2021. U.S. Air Force's new hypersonic missile program suffered a blow Monday after it failed to launch from a B-52 Stratofortress bomber flying from Edwards Air Force Base. We see that by all accounts, Russia certainly and now China, at least from what we can see, is ahead of the U.S. in this hypersonic arms race that was initiated by actions from the United States. Once again, another cell phone leading to an escalation. And of course, the really dangerous thing about hypersonic weapons, you know, other than being able to avoid missile defense, is that they reduce response times.
Right. Yeah. You got hair trigger, non-recallable weapons. Yes. Right.
So when you are trying to decide as a military technician whether that incoming blip on your screen is an actual missile and what the intentions are, is it a misfire, is it the start of World War III, you know, your political leader has only so much decision time, you know, to press the red button and destroy the world or not.
Right.
And this reduces that amount of time for decision making, which makes the whole situation more dangerous for everyone.
Especially when you've got the international climate that you have right now. You know, I mean, look, go back to 1964. What is that now? 57 years ago. Okay. Dr. Strangelove and Failsafe. Okay. The scenario in each case that was, you know, couldn't be recalled, were a B-52 with radio contact, and that their orders wouldn't allow them to turn around. And those things avoided the air defenses, according to Stanley Kubrick and whoever made the other movie, I forget. And now we're talking about things that fly, I don't know, what, five times that speed of a B-52? A lot faster. A lot smaller, a lot more nimble, and a lot closer to the ground. And no pilots to say, okay, come back.
So, this is, an ever-escalating situation. And China has good reason. They say that this – China officially says that this was not a hypersonic glide vehicle test, that it was instead a reusable space vehicle. Myself, I have to say that China has good reasons for being – for having a little bit of strategic ambiguity
right.
until this thing is fully developed and deployed as
right.
a functioning model.
Right.
That's when you want to declare a deterrent,
right.
not before you actually
While you're
have
building it.
It.
Not while you're
yeah,
building
so.
It.
I think the U.S. account in this particular case is probably pretty good. I think they probably have a good ability to differentiate between a hypersonic glide vehicle and a reusable space vehicle.
Let's say I hope so, okay? I hope if they shoot somebody to the moon that the U.S. doesn't go full nuclear on them thinking it's an attack.
Anyway, so this is a freak out, though, by the United States military saying, oh, my God, China is ahead of us in this, too, and they're a lot further along than we thought they were.
Not for nothing, by the way. Let's say that China reaches parity in terms of the, you know, the design and such and manufactures the first one. You know, if we get into a race with China over who's going to build more of something, forget it.
Actually, the Pentagon was just complaining this weekend to its military industrial complex that the price of a hypersonic missile is too much and needs to be brought down by about five times.
Good luck with that.
We were just talking last week's show about how the U.S. has a decided strategic advantage over China, having some 1,600 to 200 or 300, deployed nuclear missiles,
right.
With a wider range of being able to deliver them and a shorter launch time than their Chinese equivalent, and that this is a very vulnerable strategic situation for China, where against a major conventional confrontation off their own coast, China would not necessarily escalate to go nuclear because they would lose badly.
Right, right.
Of course, there is always first strike capability for the United States there as well.
Right.
This would be one example of how China is fighting back against that.
That's
not
right.
only building more nuclear missiles, but also developing hypersonic missiles
right.
That can avoid U.S. missile defense to deploy them.
That's right, which even provides a first strike capacity themselves.
Yes.
You know, for those who think, oh, well, they're 20 years off or whatever, I would just remind them of RCA, Westinghouse, General Electric, Sylvania, all the people that used to make TVs here in the United States, how many TVs they have around now. Well, we're almost out of time again. I don't know how this keeps happening, but I guess what's happening over the next week in 50 seconds that we keep an eye on?
One of the things that the U.S. is again failing to reach any sort of a agreement with Iran about re-entering the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, despite the U.S. under Trump pulling out of it and initiating sanctions, which involved ignoring a U.N. Security Council resolution, which was enshrined in international law.
So, yeah, we'll watch that then.
We're at a crutch point there, yeah.
We'll keep an eye on that. We'll talk about that next week. Mark, thanks a lot. It's a pleasure to speak with you as always.
Thanks for having me.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.